You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Joshua Levine is an historian and an author of several books on the World Wars, and he also worked as historical advisor on Christopher Nolan's film Dunkirk. Joshua Levine has just published Dunkirk, The History Behind the Motion Picture. Joshua Levine, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Very good to be here.
I was reading in your book about the importance of the event in terms of world history, the what-ifs, you know, had it gone the other way. And I wonder if we can start by talking about that.
Absolutely, because I think Dunkirk has been viewed as important in Britain for many years, and it's been accepted. But I think abroad, and certainly in America, there's been a tendency to view it as kind of a parochial little British story that took place before the war really got going. And that's not true. I mean, if you just sort of take it step by step, if the British Expeditionary Force, the British Army, the bulk of the British Army, had either been captured or destroyed in Dunkirk, then Britain would almost certainly have been forced to seek terms with Germany, with Hitler. And as Churchill actually stated in cabinet this time, Britain would have become a slave state. It's very clear to see that had Britain become a slave state, we would be living in a very different world today. First of all, Britain would be entirely different. A lot of us wouldn't even be alive today. But the whole of Europe would have been effectively Nazified. So all the freedoms, the liberties that we take for granted today, we wouldn't be taking any of these things for granted. We wouldn't be living them. If we extrapolate, I mean, the Second Front that the United States joined in 1944, and if Britain hadn't been holding out, what would the Second Front have been? There wouldn't have been a Second Front for the United States to join. How could there have been a D-Day and a march towards Berlin? So it clearly would have been a very, very different world we would be living in today, not just in terms of Britain, not just in terms of Europe, in terms of the entire world. And so Dunkirk does have this huge effect, and it's not just a parochial little British matter, and it's something that deserves to be remembered as the great event that I think it was.
And yet, it's a story of defeat. You were talking in the book about how the soldiers returning thought, they were shamed, and we see this in the film too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's for all that I've just said about it being an important event, it was on the back of a defeat. I mean, the fact was that the British Expeditionary Force, the French allies at this point, were very, very badly defeated, and the British soldiers, who ended up in retreat, first of all, they had very little idea why they were retreating. I mean, certainly at the beginning, they had no idea at all. British soldiers who were moving backwards. So basically, just to get for people who don't know, the British Army had moved they'd come from Britain into France at the beginning of the war. They had then, when the Germans attacked on the 10th of May, 1940, they had moved forward from France into Belgium to a prearranged position where they would face the Germans. And the idea was, what they generally believed, was they'd be facing something very similar to the First World War, a war of trenches, a war of attrition, where the two sides would be evenly matched and there probably wouldn't be a lot of movement for a lot of the time. What actually transpired was totally different, because the Germans launched this very audacious attack through the heavily forested Ardennes region with their panzer tank divisions and shot through and reached the coast, the French coast, within days. The border between France and Germany had been very, very well defended with the Maginot Line, a series of forts that stretched for miles and miles. The phrase in France was, ils ne passeront pas, they will not get through. The Germans weren't expected to be able to pass through the Maginot Line. It was so well defended. Well, as it happened, they didn't pass through it. They bypassed it. They went through the Ardennes, which the French didn't think they would be able to do. There were virtually no reserves behind there, so they were able to streak straight on through to the coast. And this exceptionally audacious attack effectively outflanked the British army and a large part of the French army, and very nearly had them surrounded. So the British army found themselves having to retreat. And as I say, they had no idea why they were retreating. Individual units thought, well, perhaps we've done something wrong and we're being sent back in shame. Others thought, well, maybe there's been a successful German attack very nearby and we're having to fall back to keep the line solid. What they didn't suspect was that an enormous German attack had taken place further south and had gone straight through to the coast. So the British retreated and retreated, and eventually all they could do was to head back into Dunkirk, the only port that was still in under Allied control. And from there, they were evacuated back to Britain. And so it was part of this great overall defeat. And the British soldiers, as they moved back and as they were evacuated back to Britain, felt that they'd been part of a great defeat and were ashamed. I mean, they felt they were part of this trampled army. And yet when they got back to Britain, they weren't treated like people who'd been defeated. They were treated as heroes. People, as they showed in the film quite accurately, that, you know, people were giving them sandwiches and bottles of beer on the trains. They were cheered in public. They were feted. People bought them drinks in bars. And the fact was, a lot of soldiers were very embarrassed about this. They thought, you know, we don't deserve this. We've done nothing glorious. But the fact, I think, is that this was the beginnings of what became Dunkirk spirit. The idea that, you know, we've had this for many, many years, this idea that in Britain we're at our best when the chips are down, when our backs are against the wall, when we're almost defeated. That's when we suddenly show our true colours. But the beginning of Dunkirk spirit was really the British coming home. The fact that at the simplest level, here are our husbands, here are our boyfriends, here are our sons, our nephews. They're coming home. They haven't been lost. But on a bigger level, we haven't lost the war. We can still hold out. Yes, there's probably an invasion coming, but the fact is that we have not been defeated, and there is still hope. That was a stirring of the Dunkirk spirit, and that's what became this idea that the British are best, you know, when things are difficult.
Well, Joshua Levine, after that occurrence, after the evacuation, then that kind of had an effect on the class consciousness of England, which was still very strong then?
It had an enormous effect on class consciousness in the sense that, I mean, it kind of tied in. What you've got to realize, so you had this evacuation at Dunkirk, which then led into the Battle of Britain, which was the fight going on in the air for control of the skies above the Channel, above southern England. And that was a German effort to win control of the sky so that they could launch an invasion. And the British held out. The British, you know, it's often said, won the Battle of Britain. Certainly they didn't lose the Battle of Britain, and that meant that the Germans didn't have control of the skies. And then following that was the Blitz, was the concerted bombing campaign that lasted for 8.5 months in an attempt to subdue Britain, subjugate Britain, and either bring about a revolution in Britain to destroy the infrastructure and destroy the morale of the people to such a degree that they rose up against their own government. Now, these are all very, very different things in the eyes of the British, in the eyes of the Germans, in the eyes of Hitler, actually. It was all sort of one concerted, single effort to subjugate Britain. And so you had this idea of Dunkirk spirit. You also had the idea of Blitz spirit. These are, you know, often considered two separate things. But essentially, they're one. They're the idea that of everybody in a very difficult situation pulling together, the country coming together as one, to rallying, trying to overcome, trying to resist this sort of dreaded enemy. And this, I think, is where the idea of class consciousness... You know, Britain, as we know, has always been very, very class-ridden, you know, much more so than the United States. Not to say the United States doesn't have its own class issues, but Britain far, far more so. And it's why around the world everybody loves to watch Downton Abbey, this sort of simplification. But, you know, there's a certain truth to it, the upstairs and the downstairs, and, you know, they get on at a certain level. Well, what this union, I think, did was to begin at some very real level to break down that class divide, because, you know, it was one of those rare occasions where everybody's interests coincided. It was in the interests of those with the power to treat everybody well, because you know the war could only be won with the help of the working man, either fighting the working men and working women who were working in the factories, producing, you know, keeping the country going. You find that industrial relations improved enormously at this time, because the factories and the manufacturing industries were hugely important. It was in everybody's interest that things worked. The workers were important, and at the same, you know, by the same token, people were suffering from the same things. The bombs didn't distinguish between the rich and the poor. Everybody was being hit. I mean, Buckingham Palace was hit several times, and this was why the Queen Mother, Queen Elizabeth at the time, the mother of the present Queen, said she could look the East End, that's the poor area of London, in the eyes, because, you know, we're all suffering together. And people tended to eat the same foods. There was rationing, so, you know, the differentiation between what people ate changed, differentiation between what the clothes people wore changed. Everyone was wearing similar sorts of clothing. People were sheltering from the bombs together. People were fire-watching, in other words, staying out looking for fires that needed to be put out together. People were volunteering for different organizations, huge elements of volunteering. So Dunkirk, leading into the Battle of Britain, leading into the Blitz, this period where the country really did, to some degree, come together. It's not a myth. I mean, there was plenty of crime as well, and there was plenty of bad behavior and people using the situation for their own ends. Let's be clear about that. But at the same token, there were people coming together in a way they never had before. So it did have a big effect on British class consciousness. You're absolutely right.
Well, what about today? Do you think people, you know, I mean, I think, trying to figure out the way to ask this. I mean, in America, there is a political faction that for some reason is wishing we could go back to a time in which there was a simpler division of power. Do you think in England that there are people who are nostalgic for a pre-war kind of class consciousness?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, certainly a pre-war, simple. You might say simplistic, because, you know, these things are, you know, nostalgia is very rarely a real reflection of what existed. It's a sort of sepia picture. Mm-hmm. But also not just pre-war, but also wartime, because, you know, there is this folk memory of a genuine time when people really were working together, and there is a, you know, why can't we do it again? Why can't we? Which is why, you know, any time there's any sort of disaster or any sort of, you know, wide-scale difficulty, people invoke this period. You know, here we are working together again. So, I mean, even actually, funny enough, you saw it in the States, you know, the flooding in Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw an article in CNN, a CNN website, you know, invoking Dunkirk's, Texas's own Dunkirk. And so yes, absolutely, people do look hark back to it. And I think, you know, in Britain recently, we've had Brexit, and yes. I think a lot of the, you know, I don't want to get overly political about this, because it's, again, it's very easy to become too simplistic about it. But I think I get a sense that a lot of the people who, you know, are wedded to this idea of Brexit, of Britain being better alone, are harking back to this period. And, you know, not necessarily it's not necessarily a mirror image, these two periods, and yet people say, you know, look at, think, well, we were better when we were apart, separated from Europe back during the war. We will be better again, separated from Europe. And it's not necessarily an analogous situation, but in the minds of people looking backwards through that nostalgic haze, that nostalgic glow, then you know, times were simply better then. And you know, I've actually written a different one. I wrote a book called The Secret History of the Blitz about the social history of this period. And you know, the fact is, you know, life wasn't necessarily better then. I mean, there were a lot of darkness, a lot of dark events taking place during this period. Because for all the fact that there were people pulling together, there were also plenty of people, sometimes the same people, pulling apart and using the situation for their own ends and exploiting others. So, you know, human nature is human nature. Nothing is ever straightforward. There's never one story. And this period is no different.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Joshua Levine, who served as historical consultant on Christopher Nolan's film Dunkirk. And Joshua Levine has written a book called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture. Well, now there are a couple of questions that came to my mind, Joshua Levine, when you were explaining exactly what had happened at Dunkirk. And so let me ask you those. It seems to me the Germans must have thought when they came through the Ardennes forest, gosh, you know, why didn't we do this in 1917? Things would have been so much. Why did the Maginot Line work in World War One and not in World War Two?
Well, I think, well, there was no Maginot Line in the First World War, but the reason, I suppose, you know, the obvious difference is that you know, the Panzer tanks, the superior mechanized equipment that the Germans had during the Second World War. And the fact was that this was a very audacious strategy. That wasn't supported by a lot of the generals. It was Hitler backed it, but it was, you know, a huge risk to go. And the only reason that they contemplated it was because they had these fast Panzer tanks that can shoot through. Now, actually, very often it's overstated, the strength of the Germans, and indeed the strength of the Panzer tanks. Most German tanks were not the modern Panzers. Most of them actually were training tanks or tanks that had been taken in Czechoslovakia. They were pretty run-of-the-mill tanks, but you know, the legend grew up that the Germans were so technologically superior, that the Germans were you know, better soldiers, that the Germans had more soldiers. Actually, things were very much more even at this time than people often remember. But the Panzers were good tanks, and this idea was formulated to go through, and it worked. It might very easily not have worked. You know, the fact that it worked, I think, reinforced in Hitler's mind his essential belief that he was a military genius. And after that, you know, in his own mind, he could never do anything wrong. He always was the last word. But it could just as easily not have worked. And if it hadn't, we would have had a very, very different war. You know, the fact was that the capability in the First World War didn't exist to go, you know, to do this kind of thing. You know, both sides, during the First World War, if you look at the First World War, both sides were doing all they could to attempt a breakthrough. I mean, you know, the British time and again, the Allies were mounting these assaults. I think the problem with the First World War, so far as offensive strategy was concerned, was that mostly, even though there were so many technological breakthroughs being made, they essentially were more useful in defense than they were in attack. So if you look at communications, for example, you know, they had decent communications, but these were, you know, sort of fixed lines, fixed telephones. And so they were very useful from defensive positions, but as soon as you started to attack, they weren't so useful anymore. And so many of the technological advancements, the machine gun, you know, very, very useful in defense, less useful in attack because they weren't mobile. So, you know, the the First World War became a war that was very, very hard fought, particularly from a defensive point of view, whereas the Second World War, you know, the Panthers were seen as this potential offensive force. So I suppose, you know, that you could say that's the difference.
Well, once they had effectively gone through the Ardennes, how were they able to pull that same trick off a second time? Isn't that exactly what they did in the Battle of the Bulge a few years later?
Well, yes. I mean, you're absolutely right. But, I mean, I think what you've got to remember about the Ardennes, I mean, people think of it as this miracle. It was so nearly a failure. So the tanks shot through, and they reached the coast. Now, as far as Hitler was very, very nervous at this point. He was worried that they'd overreached themselves, and in fact, so were the generals. I mean, Rundstedt, you see, there's this idea that Hitler allowed the British to get away at Dunkirk. Hitler's great respect for his fellow Aryan people was such that he built this golden bridge for the British to get back. And that's the idea, you know, he stopped the Panzer tank so the British could get home. It's absolutely not true, and it's not true because the Panzer attack was far less secure than people often think it was. The tanks did shoot through, but because they were so far ahead of the infantry, this was an isolated limb. And the Germans and Hitler and Rundstedt, they were very, very nervous that it could be, this limb could be just broken by a counterattack by the Allies. And then it would mean that the Germans would be the ones who would need rescuing from the coast. And that the whole Panzer tank would have been in vain. So the fact is that the Hitler's halting of the tanks, really, what he was doing was confirming an order by Rundstedt. And the reason for that order was so that the tanks could stop, so that the infantry could catch up, so that the arm could be made much further, so it wasn't so isolated. Also, so that the tanks wouldn't be vulnerable in the area around Dunkirk, which was marshy. Everybody knew that from the First World War. They wouldn't be much use in Dunkirk itself. And also, the belief was that there was a bigger fight coming south of the Somme, because the French had been defeated. It was thought that the French army was still strong and would the big fight was still to come, so that the tanks were being preserved for that fight that was to come. So this, you know, the idea of the march of the Panzers, which, you know, absolutely indicated the imminent end of the war, as far as the Germans were concerned, it wasn't. They were still very, very nervous that the Panzers were just isolated out on their own and would simply be mopped up by a counterattack by the Allies, which in truth never really came.
So why weren't we prepared when the Battle of the Bulge occurred for them to do the same thing?
Well, that's another question, and not really one that I can answer fully. I mean, I can't go into detail at that time because I simply don't know, but I mean, all I can say is that lessons in warfare can be so slowly learned, and people are always so willing to draw distinctions between this time and the last time.
Right.
I honestly can't give you a definitive answer why the lesson wasn't learned, but I mean, we could just look at so many occasions when lessons just really haven't been learned. I mean, the First World War is a pretty good example of that. It wasn't until the very end of the war that the Allies actually really started learning any good lessons from the continued stalemate and continued defeats.
So let's talk a little bit about this film, Joshua Levine, for which you were you were the consultant, the historical consultant.
Yes, I was a historical consultant. So basically, I got an email from Emma Thomas, who was the producer and wife of Christopher Nolan, the director, telling me, saying that they'd read my book. I'd done an oral history of Dunkirk, which I'd written a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and you know, very happy with it and kind of forgotten about it. And then I got this email saying that they'd read it and liked it and wondering if I wanted to come on board their film as historical consultant. Now, I don't really have any interest in film. I mean, I like films, and I sort of, you know, I've not seen a lot of films, but mainly older films. And I was aware of him, but not particularly. So he came to my house. I didn't really know who it was I had in my house. Only afterwards people were saying, you know, people reacting to me as though, you know, I'd allowed God through my front door, and I didn't really appreciate this. And I liked him very much, and we talked. He handed me the first draft of the script and left it with me overnight. And I didn't realize what, you know, an honor this was, that people, you know, don't get left with scripts by Christopher Nolan. But I read it and, you know, was very taken with it. Taken with it because, I mean, first of all, relieved that I liked him. I mean, if I hadn't liked it, I don't know what I would have said to him the next day. But relieved because I really liked the way he'd approached it, this idea of land, sea, and air, these three different arenas, and approaching it from a kind of a first-person perspective. And it made sense that, you know, that he had read my book and then come to me, because, you know, it was almost an oral history perspective that he was approaching the film with. You know, the first person. So you know, he wasn't interested in the film, in, you know, looking at Admiral Ramsay or looking at, you know, the strategy, what was happening back in Dover Castle, where the Evac Commission was being. He was interested in seeing it through the eyes of the protagonists on the ground, well, on the ground, at sea, and in the air. And I liked it for, you know, partly for that reason, partly because, you know, for example, he stresses the role of the Royal Air Force. Now, the Royal Air Force have really been forgotten from the story. And in fact, at the time, the Royal Air Force were incredibly unpopular during the evacuation and afterwards, because the soldiers and the sailors felt that they hadn't been there. They hadn't received any help from the Royal Air Force. But in fact, the Royal Air Force really were busting a gut. The pilots of Fighter Command, the Spitfire and Hurricane pilots and other aircraft as well, were busting a gut to assist and to try and attack the Luftwaffe. And that story, the fact that Christopher Nolan put that story in, I like the fact that he covered the sea. He talked about the small ships, but he also, you know, has talked about the larger ships, the naval destroyers, minesweepers, the big ferries, there's a hospital ship you see on the mole, and then the first-person perspective of, you know, the soldiers arriving in Dunkirk through the perimeter and onto the beaches. And to me, you know, it covered a lot of ground in a very real way, so I was quite taken with it. And then, I read the script, and, you know, my job as historical advisor, I have a limited power. But I do have access, you know, to the big man. I go straight, you know, I was talking constantly to Christopher Nolan saying, well, I don't think this is right, or this is right, or I suggest it. So, for example, whatever sort of input I might have had, you know, we talked through the history of it. I gave him lots and lots and lots of things that happened. And one thing that he liked very much was the idea of the leaflets, the German propaganda leaflets that were dropped out of bombers and scattered on the ground, and the British soldiers picked them up and used them in two ways, really. They used them as maps, because they didn't have their own maps, and they were actually quite useful maps to show them where Dunkirk was, and also toilet paper, because they didn't have any of that either. and Nolan liked this idea and thought it would make a very interesting visual effect. First of all, the leaflets falling out of the sky, but beyond that, a very good shorthand. You could show a map, you could show a leaflet rather, and it would immediately give the audience the idea that the British were trapped within this small area surrounded by the Germans. And it meant, you know, you didn't have to explain it. There it was on a page. So that he slightly altered the leaflet. The real leaflet was very much monochrome, was a black and white thing, very badly translated English underneath it. He made it much more colourful and snappier. But I think that really gives you a sense of our relationship, what I was there for, and also, you know, taking the reality and ever so slightly changing it. So changing the look of the leaflets, but making it, you know, very tightly based in reality. So that sort of gives you a sense of who I was, I suppose.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking tonight with Joshua Levine. He was the historical consultant on Christopher Nolan's film Dunkirk, and he's written a book called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture. And I guess maybe it was good that you were not all that familiar with Christopher Nolan's work. I mean, you might have thought, oh, you know, he's the guy who made Batman, and he's going to have Batman or some science fiction thing happen, and none of those things happened.
Well, it was. It was very useful, because first, I wasn't overawed by him when he came in. You know, I really got on with that. Really, really liked it. Sat there, we chatted for hours on the first day, and came back the second day. And then we went on a trip around Britain, meeting veterans, which was incredibly moving. I suppose it helped that I wasn't particularly overawed, but I was very impressed by him. I thought he was, you know, really, really intelligent. And don't worry, I mean, I started watching his film. I could probably do now, I don't want to stress my importance. I mean, you know, he'd have made an extremely good film without me. Don't worry about that. But at the same time, I enjoyed myself very much. It was very interesting, absolutely fascinating, also just to see how, you know, a huge motion picture works, how it's made, and to see how many people are involved. I mean, it's absolute. You know, once we were in Dunkirk and the film was being shot in Dunkirk, first of all, it was very impressive to see Dunkirk being recreated. You know, on the very spot where all this happened, there it was happening again with, you know, 1,000 extras, local people from Dunkirk, but another army of filmmakers. You know, God, there are a lot of people involved in putting this film together, which, you know, to all of these people who do it day in, day out, it's no surprise, but, you know, I was staggered by the scale of it, but also very moved by the fact that here it was again. They the mole, the big jetty that was so important for the evacuation, never intended to be a jetty, built as a breakwater to stop the actual harbour silting up. But once the German Luftwaffe destroyed the harbour, was called into action, even though a ship had never come alongside it before. Was called into action as a desperation measure, and most of the soldiers got home from that mole. Well, that was rebuilt, and you saw the destroyers offshore, you saw the smoke billowing in the distance, and a bit of sunset. You saw the soldiers on the beach. I mean, it really was incredibly moving to see all this taking shape again. And also, you know, as somebody who's writes about, you know, I've written a book now to accompany the film, and as a historian, you find out things that you couldn't have found out any other way. So, for example, I'd read in the National Archives in Britain an account by a communications officer talking about the fact that a very expensive Marconi transmission had been brought out to Dunkirk on, I think it was the 30th of May, and almost immediately gone out of service because it had got sand in the generator. And I was reading this back in London before the film was shooting, thinking, how did they let that happen? I mean, I had this picture in my mind of two clumsy naval ratings carrying the thing across the sand and dropping it, you know, like Laurel and Hardy with the piano. Dropping it in the sand and then, you know, carrying it on, you know, brushing the sand off. And, you know, we don't know what happened. And then when we were actually at Dunkirk, the wind got up. And when the wind gets up, it becomes like a sandstorm. And the sand just goes, I mean, it gets in your eyes, it's in your ears, in your mouth. You take a shower that night and it's half an inch deep in sand. You know, it's absolutely pervasive. And I suddenly thought, well, hang on a minute, this You know, doesn't that explain how the sand clogged up the generator? You know, it wasn't two clumsy racings. It was... And so the conditions, the location, if you like, retains the story. And it did that for me. It made things much clearer, being there, seeing it reenacted, brought the story back to life in a very real way, quite apart from being so moving.
Things that you can't necessarily see just by researching history, but just the way reenacting it, it comes to life.
Absolutely. I mean, people, you know, people often are very dismissive of reenactors. I know you've, in the States there are a lot of, you know, Civil War reenactors.
Yes.
And we have lots of them in Britain as well. But, you know, it's easy to be dismissive of these people as eccentrics and what have you. But, you know, by doing these things, by trying to recreate these things, you find out a lot about how things really were done and what life was like for the people who were living this for real. And certainly, you know, I think there's a lot also to the idea that a landscape really does retain a story. You know, to understand what happened at a particular time in a particular place, it really does help to study that landscape, to exist alongside it. And I found that very true of something. You know, this was a very visceral event, this evacuation. This it hadn't been planned. You know, this was ad hoc. It had to be, you know, the mole is a very good example. The fact that nobody ever wondered, well, if the harbour goes out of action, how do we take people back to Britain from this area? Well, Captain Tennant, the man who was in charge of the naval evacuation from the Dunkirk end, was the one who brought the mole into action. He decided we're going to have to use this. It's our only chance. So he brought a ship alongside it on the night of the 28th. And even though it was very, very difficult for the soldiers to get on board, and even though they were struggling with the, you know, 15-foot tidal drop and all sorts of different problems, it worked. And so that's what they did from then on. And, you know, the little ships, the famous little ships of Dunkirk, they weren't there to bring people from the beaches back to Britain. They were there to bring people from the beaches to the larger ships that were offshore, the naval destroyers, the minesweepers, the ferries that were offshore, because it was the beaches were far too shallow for the bigger ships to come in. So smaller ships were needed to bring soldiers from the beach out to the bigger ships. That's what the little ships were there for, and it was only as it went along there, and we don't have enough of these little boats. We need more, so that's why they were all brought out from Britain. It was all made up as they went along, that's in a way why that, you know, if you go there now, I do urge people, you know, to go there, because it's a fascinating, fascinating place. You will see how that landscape does retain the story, and you know, if you do go there now, I'm going on doing a tour there next year, actually. Not an advertisement, but you know, the fact is, you know, I am. You know, just looking at it, you know, you have, for example, if you go very early in the morning and have tide it out, you can find one of the paddle steamers which sunk, you know, attacked by Stuka dive bombers and was brought inshore and sank inshore. And you can see it's still there. It's so moving. The skeleton comes out of the sand early in the morning. Brutally impressive, you know, very, very tragic sight. And then you can see a ship, you know, they've just opened a restaurant, what is called the which is a very similar paddle, virtually a sister ship. So you can go and look at that in the morning and then have lunch on what it would have been had it survived. You know, it's worth going to Dunkirk to see the story, you know, laid out in front of you. I think you'll find it very living.
Well, the film, I think, it's a very beautiful film, and the film is a work of art in the sense that it's not a documentary, and some of the sequences are sort of There's like a sort of a time slip, which I guess you might expect from Christopher Nolan. But how do you feel as a historian? Do you think the film is a good film?
I do. I do. I mean, in a sense, I have to say this because I was working with historical novel. But beyond that, I do. And I think first of all, the atmosphere, the mood. I mean, the veterans, we took a lot of veterans to see it, a special veteran screening. And I was very nervous about this, what the veterans would think. And they gave it the thumbs up. So the mood, the atmosphere is right. There were people who were very quick to attack it early on and got facts wrong about it. And people were saying, a Spitfire would never have landed on the sand, for example, as it does at the end, when in fact, precisely that. And in fact, they did it for real. They actually landed it for the film. But a Spitfire and several Hurricanes landed on the sand, wheels down. So that really did happen. Again, the Spitfire ditching into the sea and staying up long enough for the pilot to get out. A lot of people say, well, that couldn't have happened. Spitfire was in a monocoque construction and would have gone straight down. Actually, again, that did happen. A lot of the knee-jerk reactions for people who knew the subject slightly were wrong. Beyond that, the atmosphere is absolutely right. And another interesting, the most interesting debate that's taken place, and I don't know how much of this you've seen in the States, but it was certainly quite big here for a while, was the idea of not showing Indian troops. This idea that somehow there was a whitewashing. That's a very interesting one, and I would argue very strongly against that because, knowing the history well, I can tell you that of hundreds of thousands of soldiers at Dunkirk, about 300 were Indian, and they all got off right at the beginning. If you were a soldier at Dunkirk, your chance of seeing an Indian soldier were virtually zero. You might have done, but virtually zero. So, from a historical point of view, there's no problem. From an artistic point of view, in any sort of historical work of fiction, you have absolute right to show who you want and who you don't want. So, no historical obligation to show any particular group. From a modern day political perspective, you can argue that till the cows come home. What ought to be shown and what ought not to be shown. It's a very interesting debate, but not really one that that's easy to answer. But it's very much a matter of, personal viewpoint. I can tell you from a historical perspective, there's no issue with that whatsoever. And colonial French troops shown in the film. I searched for a long time to, try and find, black or mixed race soldiers who really were at Dunkirk, and I managed to find two mixed race soldiers who were not on the beaches of Dunkirk, but one who was killed a few days before the evacuation. He was in the army, British army, killed a few days before the evacuation. And another who was taken prisoner after the evacuation. And neither of them would have been on the beaches of Dunkirk, but would have been in the army at the time. So, it's a very, very interesting picture overall. It's probably a testament to the film, to how how the film was viewed. All these things have become such big issues, such big stories, up to a part taking part in the debate.
Well, I thought it was a great film, and I think this is a great book. It's called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture, and the author, my guest, Joshua Levine. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Joshua Levine. His book is called Dunkirk, The History Behind the Major Motion Picture. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.